It's here and now. Members of Congress back in Washington after the elections last week have a lot on their plates. Must-pass spending bills, a free trade bill with Vietnam, and perhaps trying to avoid the freshman lawmakers who are having their Capitol Hill orientation today. Debate about changing strategy in Iraq dominated the political chat shows over the weekend, with top Democrats saying their first priority when they take the reins of Congress next year is a phased redeployment of U.S. troops. This morning, Michigan Senator Carl Levin took issue with the president and vice president for saying the U.S. is absolutely winning in Iraq and is going full speed ahead there.
Those were statements made just a few weeks ago, ignoring the obvious reality on the ground in Iraq, that we're getting deeper and deeper into a hole, that we should stop digging, and that we should look for alternatives in order to promote the chances of success in Iraq.
Joining us on the line now from Washington to talk about this and more is John Harwood, columnist for The Wall Street Journal and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Hi, John.
Morning.
President Bush is meeting with the Iraq Study Group today, which is due next month to present him with how to change course in Iraq. His chief of staff, Josh Bolton, has said the president's open to new ideas, but doesn't think the White House will back a timetable for withdrawal. So, John, your view on this, will President Bush not entertain the phased redeployment idea?
Well, I think the question of phased redeployment is exactly what does that mean? That term could be very elastic and encompass a wide variety of things, including some of the initial plan that the Bush administration wanted to do all along, which was to stand down U.S. troops as Iraqi soldiers could stand up. Obviously, that's not working, or certainly not working fast enough, and the security situation in Baghdad is not any better. So I think the question is, how does the administration redefine victory in a way that will allow it to change course and still achieve what the president says he wants, which is not to leave Iraq a disaster.
With much debate yet to come, does it sound like you today that policy or strategy is going to change much in Iraq?
I do think it's going to change. And we saw a rapid demonstration after the election with the replacement of Rumsfeld. Now the question is, what can Bob Gates do? Bob Gates, of course, is part of that Iraq study group. Clearly, it's going to change. The question is it the kind of change that a year from now is going to see a much reduced profile of American troops, or just a reconfiguration and something that will allow the president to continue trying to achieve his goals?
Much of the political talk in Washington at the moment is about cooperation between the parties, but the incoming House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, surprised many people by backing outspoken war critic John Murtha of Pennsylvania, Congressman Murtha, to be the next majority leader. Were you surprised? What's it mean, and how are Republicans viewing the Murtha move?
I was surprised by that. You know, the Democrats avoided a fight last week when Rahm Emanuel, who headed the Democratic campaign for the House of Representatives, sidestepped a leadership fight against a prominent member of the Congressional Black Caucus. That was the kind of conflict resolution Democrats were hoping would take place in the majority leader's fight, but that's not happening, and John Murtha's pressing with Nancy Pelosi's help. Remember, Murtha was her campaign manager when he opposed Steny Hoyer, when she opposed Steny Hoyer a few years ago. Steny Hoyer is the guy that Murtha's now opposing, and it has added resonance right now because one of the themes of the election was the rise of some more centrist Democrats. Steny Hoyer is the centrist in that fight, and John Murtha is the candidate of the sort of anti-war left, and it's not the kind of intramural argument that Democrats would have liked to have had a week after their election.
John, the Republican leadership is crafting a short list of items it wants to try and push through before it loses control of Congress. With about 90 seconds left, let's click through some of the issues up and down. Will there be action or not? First, the nomination of former CIA Chief Robert Gates to be the next defense secretary, up
yes,
or down?
Yes, he'll be confirmed, and Harry Reid told the president as much in his Oval Office meeting last week.
Confirmation of John Bolton as UN ambassador.
Not going to happen. That nomination is dead, and the question is, when does the administration recognize it and pick another choice?
Tax breaks for college tuition.
I would not expect that to happen. That's on the Democratic agenda item for next year. I think they'll park that and try to work it out in the spring.
Oil and gas drilling, opening a large area of the Gulf of Mexico to drilling.
I think that is not likely to happen. The environmental community realizes that they now have a stronger hand and can prevent bills that recently they might have accepted coming out of the Senate as compared to a more aggressive House bill, but I don't think that's going to happen this year.
Bottom line, will the lame duck Congress get much done?
No, it won't get much done. The principal things that we'll do are get a new Pentagon chief confirmed and then pass the spending bills. Of course, they've got to either do a continuing resolution or some sort of authorization for spending, but they're not going to do a whole lot of legislating. Democrats are going to want to regroup and press their advantage in the spring next year.
John Harwood, columnist for The Wall Street Journal and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
It's orientation day for freshman lawmakers on Capitol Hill, learning such things as proper Capitol Hill attire. They'll also have a say in the election of new leaders. Among the newly elected is Carol Shea Porter of New Hampshire. National political pundits were shocked when Shea Porter defeated well-funded Republican incumbent Congressman Jeb Bradley with almost no money and no help from the National Democratic Party. Party Chairman Howard Dean didn't even know her name. Shea Porter is now New Hampshire's first congresswoman-elect, thanks to an army of dedicated volunteers and what's been called one of the most effective campaign commercials of the political season, a no-frills ad featuring the candidate sitting at a table arm-in-arm with her mom.
My mother has been a lifelong Republican, and I'm a lifelong Democrat.
That's right. Please vote for my daughter, Carol Shea Porter. She's a hard worker, and I know she'll do a great job.
Carol Shea Porter joins us on a cell phone now from the echoey halls of Congress. Thanks a lot, and welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
You had a campaign war chest of just $200,000 against $1 million for the incumbent. You were a true dark horse candidate, not given much chance at all to win, and yet you pulled it out. How?
Well, we always thought that we would win, and the reason for that was we had our ears very close to the ground, and we knew what the message of the New Hampshire voter was. They wanted us to address the problems facing this country, and they wanted us to do it in a warmer, friendlier tone. And my family is a Republican family, and I knew that I could speak across the aisle and still stay true to, you know, my agenda. So I think that really resonated.
Some say you simply caught the blue wave and were swept into office with all the other Democrats across the nation. But I know you think there was more to it than that in play for you. For you, it was the grassroots movement.
Yes, and I had to get through a primary first. And so clearly there was something else going on. And what it was, once again, was tapping into those people who have not been involved in politics before. And they came forward because they could hear their voice. And I kept saying I would represent all of us, and I was going to Congress for the rest of us, the bottom 99%. And they knew who they were, and they just came forward, and they're the reason for the victory.
So keeping your constituents in mind, what's your top-related issues priority on Capitol Hill now that you're there and are looking forward to January when you get in?
Well, I said that we had a plate full of trouble down in Washington. Obviously, this war in Iraq, and I promised to stand there and call for a withdrawal, and I will stay true to that promise. Within 6 months, I thought would be a reasonable timetable for that. I also said that I understood the problem they were having with health care and that I would fight to change health care. And I said I wasn't sure that I would see it in my terms, but that I would fight for it. And then also this deficit, which worries all of us and should. It's like a train wreck waiting to happen. So, you know, and I also talked about this environment, which is a crisis. So a plate of troubles, you know, four major issues there and many more. But the promise was that they would hear their own voice down in Washington.
Let me ask you a question about your first issue, the first issue you mentioned, a change of U.S. strategy in Iraq. A new voter survey says that voters are expressing concern over pushing too fast to get out. How do you respond to that?
My answer to that is that we have been there as long as it took us to win World War II. So I don't think we're moving too quickly at all. I think it's time to have a strategy that says leave within 6 months and redeploy troops in the area and countries that are willing to have us, because it is a hotbed. And I think that if you listen to the Republicans, senators who have been there, as well as Democrats, it's not just one party or the other calling for a withdrawal. It's clear that we have a failed policy and we need to turn direction quickly.
Are you prepared to compromise on the timetable if Democratic congressional leadership says 6 months might be too fast?
I am prepared to compromise a little bit as long as they have a clear-cut date or they have a commitment that we will be going. I mean, you have to be able to talk to everybody and look at it. But my issue here is to make sure that we set that date and that we don't drag this out any longer. And I'm a former military spouse, and so I have felt morally obligated to speak up for those troops because they are just stuck in the middle of something.
Let me ask you about congressional atmosphere. How will you work to make sure that the traditional bickering between Republicans and Democrats doesn't reappear as it always does?
Well, you know, when you're passionate about issues, it can get pretty tense. But I ran a campaign that never had a personal attack, either in the primary or in the general election, and I plan to be a voice like that. And also, I do have a background as a social worker and administrator, and I taught politics. So I think I can merge the two of them, like I have in my own life, and reach out to people while still holding true to, you know, the basic values and reasons that I ran for this office.
And finally, Carol Shea Porter, is it a little goosebumpy today? Is it exciting to be walking the halls of Congress as a congresswoman-elect?
It truly is an honor. It is just an inspiring place, as you know. And I used to come here with my children, and so I keep shaking my head thinking, I can't believe that, you know, I'm here now to serve the people of my district. And I think we should all keep track of that thought, that we have been sent by good people to do good work.
Starting in January, Carol Shea Porter will represent the 1st District of New Hampshire in the 110th Congress. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is about to take his place among presidents and war heroes. Thousands gathered today for the groundbreaking of the King Memorial, the first monument on the National Mall dedicated to an African American. President George Bush, former President Bill Clinton, Senator Barack Obama, and poet Maya Angelou all attended the ceremony.
This man shall be remembered, not with statutes, rhetoric, not with legends and with poems and wreaths of bronze, but with the lives that have grown out of his life.
The King Memorial will include a sculpted likeness of King and possibly waterfalls flowing over a wall engraved with King's words. Just ahead, the latest on President Bush's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, but first, more voices from students who spoke at the King commemoration on the Mall.
Dr. King taught me to express what I believe. You have to stick up for yourself sometimes. You can't just expect them to let you ride on the front of the bus.
A dream I have for America is that there are no differences of skin color. I think people should be judged by what's inside their hearts and their characters, not by the color of their skin.
Dr. King was a very noble man. I respect him because he was not afraid of standing up for his beliefs and had a passion for his beliefs. What I want to see happen in our land is people standing up for their beliefs and having the same exact passion that he did.
The Democratic sweep in last week's congressional elections hangs over today's meeting between President Bush and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. There are worries in Israel that the Bush administration, faced with Democrats who will control Congress in January, may soften the U.S. approach to Iran and the Palestinians. Stephen Erlanger is Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times and joins us now from Jerusalem. Steve, hello and thanks.
Happy to do it.
Steve, you could say that President Bush is on the defensive, in a way, after last week's elections here in the U.S., but how firm is Olmert's political footing there in Israel going into this meeting?
He's been weakened because of the performance of the Israeli army in the war in Lebanon this summer and the perception that he didn't manage it very well. But politically, in an odd way, he's okay. He's broadened his coalition quite a lot by bringing in another party. And no one, you know, in the center-left wants new elections because they know the right will actually win. So I think he's safe for now, but he's safe but without a lot of passion behind the safety.
Well, what does Olmert want from this meeting? What does he need from this meeting to bring home to satisfy those people who are still criticizing him?
Olmert needs to bring back a sense that despite the war in Lebanon, Israel is still considered in high esteem, that he himself is considered in high esteem, and most important of all, that the United States trusts his leadership partly with the Palestinians, and that the United States confirms its support for Israel, and particularly in respect of an Iran which both countries believe is seeking nuclear weapons. This is the nightmare for Israel, the prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran, the one that, you know, says that it wants Israel to disappear, but even if it does nothing with a nuclear weapon, would affect the balance of power in the Middle East. Now, George Bush has said that the idea of a nuclear-armed Iran is insupportable, but the Israelis are worried that Mr. Bush's loss of control of both House and Senate and his need to force the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld means that he's less capable of pushing through his policies.
The Israelis are worried the U.S. might wait too long to stop Iran from building a nuclear weapon.
Yes, I mean, the Israelis are worried that the United States, partly because, you know, it needs the support and help of Europeans and moderate Arabs for its policies in Iraq, let alone to build any notion of sanctions on Iran, is going to dither on Iran and not, you know, confront what in Israel's mind is a clear effort by Iran to waste time while it develops a nuclear bomb.
How concerned is Israel that the U.S. might try to build an international consensus to pressure Iran, and in order to attract allies to that cause, it'll have to agree to pressure Israel to ease up on the Palestinians?
They are worried about this. On some level, it's logical. The United States' interests and Israel's interests are not precisely the same. And it's easier for the United States to keep Arab allies happy when it is seen to be pushing Israel to be doing something for the Palestinians. George Bush has been a very close friend to Israel and has not provided that kind of pressure in the past. But the concern from Israel is that Bush will. And it comes at a time when the Palestinians seem particularly at odds with themselves about what it is they want, the rivalry between Hamas and Fatah. The Israelis are worried that, you know, for a good end, possibly, you know, a coalition against Iran, the coin will be paid in the shekel.
Let's look at this from the other point of view, if we might. How concerned is the White House that Israel might be willing to go it alone and take some sort of action against the Iranians over the nuclear program, maybe military action?
Israel would never, I think, you know, do an attack on Iran without long consultations with the United States. I mean, I don't think surprise is the issue. But the two countries do have a slightly different timeline for Iran that makes them nervous. The Israelis keep saying that the key moment is when Iran has the technical expertise to produce a bomb. Then, after it has that, it's just a kind of an industrial project to produce enough nuclear fuel to build a bomb. While the Americans tend to think more about when Iran will actually have a bomb. So their notions of when the crucial time is crossed are slightly different.
Can I come back to politics for just a moment? In your story in the New York Times today, you remind us, as you did at the beginning of the interview, of the questions of competence that arose in Washington about Prime Minister Olmert following the Israeli war in Lebanon this summer. Do those questions still hang over his head as far as Washington is concerned as Olmert arrives here for his talks?
I think they do. And in part, they hang over his head because they hang over his head in Israel. I mean, you know, Olmert was Ariel Sharon's deputy, but became prime minister to some degree in a form of tragic accident when Sharon suffered this stroke and fell into a coma last January, something he's not woken from. Now, Olmert did a good job in bringing this new party to power, but He doesn't have the same kind of support that Sharon did, and most Israelis think Sharon would have handled, rightly or wrongly, the war in Lebanon differently.
So how does that, do you think, color what's at stake for both the U.S. and for Prime Minister Olmert during this visit?
It makes the stakes higher, certainly for Olmert, also a little bit for Bush. It's not the most important thing George Bush is doing. But for Olmert, being perceived as still very close to the President of the United States is very important in Israeli terms. Israelis feel they have only one true ally in the world, which is the United States. And George Bush Jr. has been one of the friendliest presidents to Israel they've ever experienced. So the fact that he and Olmert still have a close relationship is very important for Olmert's sake back home.
Steve Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times, who's speaking to us from Jerusalem, where Israelis are watching Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's meeting with President Bush today. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
It's Here and Now. Representatives of more than 190 countries are gathered in Kenya today for the UN Climate Change Summit. Today, we're going to look at how one country is trying to deal with global climate change. Here and Now's Sean Carberry recently traveled to Iceland, and he joins us in the studio now. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Bob.
Sean, Iceland is an interesting case because it's seeing lots of glacial melting, and it also has plans to become oil-free.
It does, Bob. The goal is by the year 2050 to be completely renewable, and this is going to be a particular challenge with their transportation fleet, their fishing fleet, vehicles. They're working on hydrogen technology to transform that. Their heat, hot water, electricity all come from renewable sources currently, hydroelectric and geothermal power. The geothermal energy also creates pools and spas where people bathe year-round, and I was able to visit one after first visiting a glacier and a geothermal power plant.
We're driving through a post-glacial lava field through nasty wind and rain. The surrounding terrain is rough black lava with a rich lime-green moss and grassy covering. It's a rather alien but actually strangely beautiful look, and small peaks crop up on either side of the road. Every now and then, columns of steam rise from the black and green landscape, revealing evidence of the geothermal energy below. We hit the road to meet up with Odur Sigurdsson. He's a geologist at the Hydrological Service of the National Energy Authority.
Describe where we are right now.
Now we are in the very southern part of Iceland, close to the Atlantic coast, and right behind us is this ice cap of Mýrdalsjökull, which is the southernmost ice cap of Iceland.
Okay, well, let's go take a look at the glacier. Whoa!
This is a glacier snout, or terminus of a glacier, outlet glacier, which has been measured annually for 75 years. And it turns out that it is mimicking the climate very closely, particularly the summer temperature. During the last 9 years, since 1997, it has retreated from the big rock over there by the river and up to there, which is half a kilometer in 9 years. So it's retreating at a very fast pace compared to what it has done previously.
If we were standing here 75 years ago,
yes,
how much snow would be, or ice would be on top of us, how far would it extend down towards the sea?
It would extend to the hills over there, which is about 700 meters or half a mile from here. Right here we would be at 100 meters depth in the ice.
20, 30 years from now, where do you expect the ice cap to be?
Well, in 10 years it'll be half a kilometer more back, and continue for quite some time in that pace.
I think that's more than enough for the location. We can go back inside and talk in comfort.
Yes. Now we're soaking wet, so it's fine.
When we foolishly attempted to run outside and look at the glacier in this weather, you're describing that it's receded pretty dramatically. What are the broader implications for the surrounding environment or even the global environment of this glacier and its recession?
Well, it's expected that more or less all Icelandic glaciers will disappear during the next two centuries. Of course, these small Icelandic glaciers have hardly any effect on the global ocean level, but it's an indication what other glaciers are doing. And Icelandic glaciers are so easily accessible that they are very important to be able to tell what other glaciers may be doing or are doing.
So the actual geological impact may be small, but the scientific impact can be very large.
Yes, it's very appropriate to put it in this way.
Certainly one thing that can help slow the process and eventually perhaps reverse the trend is expanded use of alternative energy. To get a better sense of Iceland's use of geothermal resources for energy production, Grimmer Bjornsson, geothermal reservoir engineer at the Reykjavik Energy Authority, is driving us out to a new geothermal power plant that will be coming online shortly.
Oh, you can see straight ahead that there are steam pillars coming out here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 of them. And that's where we are going. We are going to what is called Hellisheiði power plant. So it's a new power plant. At the very end, it's going to be in the excess of 300 megawatt power plant, electrical, and another 300 megawatt thermal. So it's going to both produce electricity and hot water for the city of Reykjavik.
We've just driven up a hill past the power plant that actually used to be a ski resort, but in the last decade, snowfall has been diminishing to the point where they closed it down and turned it over to the power company. Anyhow, just outside our truck here is a giant cylinder where steam is billowing out at an incredible volume.
The well is inside this dome structure here, and we call this a directional well. It is drilled to the northeast. It intersects several faults, and we are taking out 40 kilos per second of 250 Celsius fluid out of this one.
What exactly is the content of that steam coming out of that vent?
Oh, this is 99% just pure water.
In 2 weeks, if I were to come back, I wouldn't see this steam coming out of the vent.
It would be absolutely quiet. So it would just go through the pipes into the power plant, and it would be utilized there either by the steam turbine for electrical generation, or that the separated fluid will be used for the thermal part of the power plant.
And from the power plant to the fringe benefits of geothermal power production. When I spoke with Guðni Ólafsson in the Ministry of Environment, he said the Blue Lagoon is perhaps the most recognizable geothermal feature of Iceland. So we've come to investigate, and I'm joined by
Magnea Guðmundsdóttir, and I'm Director of Public Relations for the Blue Lagoon.
When did this open?
July of 1999, but people have been bathing in the Blue Lagoon since the early 1980s.
Tell me about that history, because I understand that this evolved as byproduct of a power plant.
Initially, yes. We have this geothermal seawater, which can be found as deep as 2,000 meters or 6,000 feet underneath. And our power company, Hitaveita Suðurnesja, they drill for this hot fluid. They use the steam to produce electricity. They also use the steam to heat cold water, which is used for central heating. The Blue Lagoon was initially formed when they had used the fluid or the steam for these purposes. And then they let it fall back into the lava field, but instead of sinking down, it formed a lagoon.
Okay, well, I'm going to head into the locker room to change, and then I'll be right back out to experience the joys of geothermal bathing.
All right. The water you're sitting in is what you call geothermal seawater. It's a combination of fresh water and the Atlantic Ocean, you could say that. It's also very rich in minerals. One is the Blue Lagoon silica. And it also contains the blue-green algae. It's a combination of the algae and the silica that gives the lagoon its unique milky blue color.
What's the temperature of this water?
It's around 37 to 39 degrees Celsius.
That is about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Our audio postcard from Iceland was produced by Here and Now's Sean Carberry, with production assistance from Dahlia Domian. For photographs and more, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. A case before a judge in New Hampshire tomorrow could determine the fate of the sign bandit. Stratham, New Hampshire resident John Decker was arrested in August and charged with theft after he removed a roadside sign that was advertising the sale of a hot tub. In fact, Decker has been removing a lot of roadside signs over the past year or so, and he's been attracting a lot of attention and gathering fans. John Decker joins us on the line now from his home in New Hampshire. Hi, John.
Hi.
What got you started removing these signs?
Well, the hot tub guy had put a couple of signs. One was in front of my house, and another one was next to my house. And when I saw the sign, I said, gee, you know, somebody behind my house is selling a hot tub. Well, then I started seeing the signs everywhere, and sort of made me mad because it said, you know, hot tub for sale, new, still in package, and looks like it's done a felt pen. So I felt duped, so I started picking them up when I saw them. And, you know, after I had a couple hundred of them, I started thinking, you know, this isn't right. And then I started noticing 1-800-GOT-JUNK signs and Match.com signs. Just about every company on earth seemed to be a trend that was starting up.
What is it you're trying to prove, John?
Well, what I'm trying to prove is that the state, this is a vacation state, and it's supposed to be a beautiful state. And when there's a sign every 50 feet advertising Got Junk or Goji Juice, which is a health drink, and a hot tubs for sale, it doesn't look right. And the other thing is that there's a state law saying it's against the law to put roadside signs up next to any state highway, and the states refuse to enforce it.
Respond to the authorities who say it isn't legal to remove someone else's property in this way.
Well, you know, one man's property is another man's litter. and it's sort of like my goal is to get the police to arrest the guy putting the signs down rather than someone who would take the signs up. I've asked the police, I've asked code enforcement officers, I've asked the state to remove the signs, and they'll say, well, you've encountered a gray area of the law. Well, there's a state law that says you can't put these signs down on state roads. One of the defenses in my trial tomorrow is going to be a little-known part of the New Hampshire Constitution that says when the state is unwilling or unable to act, a citizen shall be compelled to do so.
So you feel that you've been wrongly accused of theft, then?
Yes. Yes, I do.
And what do you expect to happen at your court hearing?
I don't know what to expect exactly. I could very well be found guilty. It's a trial before a judge, not a jury. I think if it was a jury, I would be acquitted. But my goal is to keep this issue alive so that we can change legislation, making a fine structure, you know, for every sign put down, there's a $5 or a $10 fine. I may be found guilty tomorrow, then we may appeal it because the Jim Splaine, who's a state rep in Portsmouth, is writing new legislation, but it won't come before the House until September. So the longer this is in the public eye, the better it is for me. And the stakes aren't very high. I mean, I'm anticipating a fine of $300 to $1,200.
I understand there's an event in your honor tonight.
Yes, it's called The Sign Bandit Sings. I was a musician in Lake Tahoe for years and kind of hung up my trumpet and my voice, and I decided it was a good time to have a day before the trial celebration, and the proceeds benefit the Seacoast Interfaith Hospitality Network.
Do you have a song that you feel is symbolic of what you're going through right now?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask you to sing part of it in a moment, but first, tell me what you've done with all those signs. Have you tossed them, or are they sitting in a backyard shed or something?
What I do now is I usually call the people that put them down, and I say, I have your signs, and then I also call the police and say, I have the signs. So I don't want to be arrested again, and the issue of theft is you have to steal them. If I tell them I have them, come get them, they can't accuse me of stealing them. So I do have messy sign buildup. I have several hundred signs at any one time. Sometimes I throw them away. Sometimes I just keep them.
Okay, John Decker, I want to say thank you very much. Good luck when you go to court tomorrow. John Decker joined us from Stratham, New Hampshire. And John, as we go, sing us out. Give us the Sign Bandit song.
Just give me some kind of sign, girl. Oh, my baby, show me that you're mine. Oh, yeah. Give me some kind of sign, girl. Yeah, my baby. How's that?
It was beautiful.
Okay. No one's coming now, I can tell you that.
Just give me some kind of sign, girl. Oh, my baby. To show me that you're
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Now, if you've listened to public radio for more than 10 minutes this year, you'll probably recognize this voice.
For my 13th birthday, I planned a slumber party with all of my girlfriends, but a couple of weeks beforehand, my mother took me aside and said, I need to speak to you privately. September 10th is not your birthday, it's October 10th. And I said, what?
Julia Sweeney is the Saturday Night Live alum who spun her androgynous character, Pat, into a successful career as a comic actress from Broadway to Hollywood. Sweeney is now touring with a new show, Letting Go of God, a hilarious yet sobering series of monologues about her trek from Catholicism to atheism, in which she takes on all guises of religion and spares no one.
You know, a few months ago, Stephen Hawking came out and said that his theory that black holes obliterate anything that falls into them, probably one of his biggest contributions to science, the theory that much of his particular fame and reputation is based on, probably isn't right. Wouldn't it be great if the Pope could just do the same thing? If he could just come out and say, oh my, I've been reading what science shows us about our spectacular but very humble place in this universe, and I have to say that it is thrilling and mind-boggling beyond all imaginings. It makes the Bible so puny and uninspired and certainly less poetic by comparison. I am terribly sorry. I sincerely misunderstood so much. I almost wish there were a God so that I could be punished for all of the suffering that I have obliviously caused in this world. But since there will be no cosmic punishment for me, I will spend the rest of my life working in a family planning clinic in Latin America. Good day.
Joking aside, Sweeney does not take religion lightly. After a recent performance at Harvard's Sanders Theater, she took a few questions from the audience, beginning with one about whether politicians should have to explain what they mean by their faith in God.
I would love to see these questions of politicians, because the truth is, somebody who says they don't believe in God cannot be elected in the United States. I mean, any race can be elected, any religion at this point, really, but that is the final frontier. And yet, people won't ask politicians that. And my feeling about most politicians is that they do what the people respond, you know, what respond to. And if you started asking, if we all started asking politicians point blank exactly what their faith was in and why they believed that, if that was possibly able to do that in a public way, they would start changing their tune, possibly.
My question is, do you think that humanism is going to become more acceptable in our society going forward, and will it be easier to be an atheist going forward?
I think that my guess is that, and I could be wrong, that people who are sort of vaguely moderate, educated, liberal, kind of on the liberal side of religiosity, kind of just need a permission slip to be able to just say, I don't believe it. Like, it's not as socially acceptable, I don't think it was 10 years ago, to just say you didn't believe it, because we've all been raised, and in some ways for good reason, to be very politically correct and to think of faith as a good thing and to think that's, you know, like, I accept everyone's vision of how the world is like something we've all been raised to be, which is a good thing. But it has a really bad dark side, which we see every day in the news. So I think now, in the face of what's happening in our world, people are more willing to say that they're non-religious or even atheist. I think atheist is still going to be a really tough word for most people. But I do think that, like, being a humanist, that's a great way, that's something that you can say, I'm a humanist, that has a philosophy, it has a way of being. You don't have to, like, put in somebody's face that you don't believe in God. So I think is going to become more popular or more accepted, I think, I hope.
Me too, thank you.
Hi, I grew up in Alabama, and I was just kind of shocked at how much I identified with your story, because growing up in Protestant Alabama, I kind of really didn't even know what a Catholic was. But I just wanted to know what age you had this epiphany, or you started this journey on kind of really questioning who God was and what role religion played in your life.
Well, I try really hard not to exaggerate my religiosity before I stop believing in God, because to me, my faith in God, even though I had this, you know, like, religious experience, and I really dipped into the idea of God when I was in crisis and needed
that concept to help me cope. In general, I was a fairly skeptical, cynical person about religion, you know, and so I think I had a typical attitude about religion to my peers, which was, I could see through, the stories were funny, and we laughed at a lot of the Catholic stuff, but at the same time, it was still acceptable to dip into it and believe in God if you needed to during a crisis or something like that. That wasn't, that didn't seem like a contradiction to me. And what I wanted to do was dramatize how even open-minded, basically somewhat thinking person's view of God that was even already a little skeptical, even to just let go of that, even to just go that far, you know, you don't have to go from a fundamentalist to atheist, but even from just a sort of believing person to a non-believing person is a huge worldview shift and has dramatic effects in every part of your life. So, and I was like 38 when I had that breakup, and then I would say it was like 38 to 41 where I was really questioning all that stuff. So that was my age.
I was going to ask you if you have suffered any sort of backlash or ever felt at risk or threatened or maybe bullied by people who don't agree with you, if you ever receive, you know, hate mail or anything like that.
Oh, I have lots of hate mail. although much less, as a percentage of my total mail, it's very small, actually. And, you know, the hate mail is, you know, it's funny. I was actually thinking I'm going to put some on my website, just my
best messages
of hate mail, because some of them are pretty good. And some of them, you know, they make their points, you know. Anyway, after the show was on This American Life, Ira Glass did a 20-minute segment of the show, and it was just became this enormous thing. Like, I got 3,000 emails in, like, 2 weeks, and then I probably got another couple thousand emails over the next couple months. And some of those emails were really angry and threatening, but I think I did have a moment of feeling scared, and then I didn't. You know, it was just like, and it's hard to tell when it's threatening. You know, like, I know where you live, and well, I don't like you. Is that a threat? I don't know. You know, like, but it doesn't make you feel very good.
I think what we're gonna do is we're gonna have you now sign some CDs. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. What an honor to be here. Thank you.
Julia Sweeney at Harvard Sanders Theater. Her show, Letting Go of God, is touring nationally. The CD version of the performance was released last week. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
I think my parents had been mildly disappointed when I told them I didn't believe in God anymore, but being an atheist was another thing altogether. Well, the first call I got from my mother was really more of a scream. Atheist! Atheist! My father got on the phone and said, "You have betrayed your family, your school, and your city." It was like I'd sold secrets to the Russians. They both said they were not going to speak to me anymore. My dad said, "I don't even think you should come to my funeral." After I hung up, I thought, just try and stop me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bob Oakes. Robin Young is back tomorrow. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Bob Oakes. Join us next